Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk. It's been a hell of a month, hasn't it? With all the bad news out of Israel and Ukraine this week, not to mention Washington. You may have missed, as I did initially in my morning doom scrolling, an unnerving story from the cyber war front. Chinese military hackers, the Washington Post reported, have been quietly infiltrating American infrastructure. A water utility in Hawaii, a big port on the West Coast, and at least one oil and gas pipeline, the story said, with the idea of lying in wait until orders come from Beijing to create chaos and panic here when hostilities break out between the U.S. and China. The hackers have slithered into similar infrastructures of U.S. allies abroad, the paper said. To break all this down and add up what it means, my guest today is the co-author of that Post story, Ellen Nakashima, a prize-winning national security and intelligence reporter at the Washington Post. Let me tell you something about her. The day I arrived to work at the Post in 2010, an editor introducing me around nodded towards Ellen's desk, where she was intensely working the phones, and whispered, "She's relentless." Indeed, Nakashima's been a member of three Pulitzer-winning teams at the Post, including in 2022 for an investigation of the January 6th assault on the Capitol, in 2018 for digging into Moscow's efforts to influence the 2016 election, and in 2018 for exploring the hidden scope of digital surveillance by the National Security Agency. It's no surprise that Ellen Nakashima piloted this major story on Chinese infiltration of our critical infrastructure. Ellen Nakashima, welcome to Spy Talk. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I've admired your work for so many years, going back to when we were colleagues at the Washington Post a dozen years ago. Anyway, you and your Washington Post colleague, Joseph Menn, wrote a story a couple of days ago that appeared with a rather startling headline, "China's Cyber Army is Invading Critical U.S. Services." You went on to write, as officials told you, the intrusions are part of a broader effort to develop ways to sow panic and chaos or snarl logistics in the event of a U.S.-China conflict in the Pacific. Well, break that down for us, will you?
Yeah. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me. It is indeed good to be with you as being back in the kind of in the room with you as we were once over a decade ago together. So our story here is to raise awareness about a fairly stealthy campaign the Chinese military has been doing in the cyber world, where they are penetrating companies that are either in the area of critical infrastructure or adjacent. You know, they're in somewhere in the supply chain that serves power, water, ports, logistics, things like that.
You wrote specifically, among the victims are a water utility in Hawaii, a major West Coast port, and at least one oil and gas pipeline.
That's right. As well as some electric utilities in other countries outside the U.S. Now, there has been no indication that any of these intrusions has resulted in an actual disruption or, you know, stoppage of water or power. But the point is that the U.S. government, including the intelligence agencies, have determined that China is developing ways to be able to disrupt these critical services if they should be directed to in the event of a conflict one day. Not that they are definitively going to do so or they have a plan to do so right now, but they want to be able to be capable of doing so should the need arise. Mm-hmm. So that's the message.
I think you described this technique or this campaign, attributing it to a U.S. official, as they've shifted from espionage. I mean, it's not that they've abandoned espionage in the United States,
but they've
shifted in this particular campaign, which is codenamed Volt Typhoon, that they've shifted in this case from espionage to a kind of lurking, almost a guerrilla kind of war where they get into place ready to spring up should a conflict break out.
Right. China is still engaging in massive espionage, cyber espionage, and commercial espionage. And the sort of foreign intelligence service, their equivalent of the CIA, the MSS, is conducting broad espionage efforts against the U.S. and other countries. But here, what's sort of new, or what the U.S. government has come to assess only within the last year or so, is that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, the military side of the house, those hackers have been intruding into critical infrastructure targets and entities, not for military intelligence purposes, but to be able to, if they ever should need to or want to, potentially disrupt these systems to create an atmosphere of fear, doubt, panic. Kind of like, you remember what happened with Colonial Pipeline
a couple years ago?
Mm. That was the Russians. But when that pipeline, that gas pipeline was disrupted, it created huge long lines of, you know, gas lines on the East Coast, and fears that there would be all sorts of disruptions. And that is the sort of fear and panic that people think could happen.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, turning out the lights, turning off the heat, turning off all the energy supplies would definitely throw the country into panic beyond just long gas lines. We're talking about, as you said, creating panic and chaos. Remind me of the Colonial Pipeline deal. Was that definitively pinned on a particular adversary? It was China or Russia?
It was Russia. Yeah, and the irony was, I don't think that it was a Russian government effort to necessarily cause disruption, because the it was a ransomware attack, and it could have been more opportunistic. And then the hackers got into what we call the IT or administrative side of the Colonial Pipeline's networks, not their actual industrial control operational side that moves the gas. However, out of an abundance of caution, Colonial shut down their pipeline, and that's what caused all of the snarls and the dislocations and the disruptions. And so you saw the potential impact of such a cyber attack, you know, on a critical infrastructure sector. And that's what raised ransomware attacks to the level of a potential of national security. Up until that point, the U.S. government looked at ransomware as much more of a sort of criminal commercial issue that was hurting businesses. And to be sure, you know, schools and hospitals, but it hadn't risen to the level of a national security event that got the attention of the president, President Biden. He raised it with Vladimir Putin when they met in Geneva that summer.
I'm not sure if it was your reporting or not. I think it was, excuse me, for that lapse. But did you not report that Biden did not bring up this Volt Typhoon campaign when he met with President Xi Jinping?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What do you make of that?
Well, I make of that they had a long four-hour meeting. Of course, that also includes translation time, interpretation time. But there was a long list of items that they had to get through, and this one just didn't sort of make it up into the conversation mix. But cyber has always been something that the two sides, you know, that's been an issue between the two sides for years.
Yeah, I mean, it's been going on for ages. I want to get back to that question momentarily. But in the case of Volt Typhoon, the code name for this campaign, do you have an idea of how long the Chinese were in these utilities, gas companies, electric companies, so on, before they were detected?
So my understanding is in these cases, and we said that there have been about two dozen identified in the U.S. Over the last year, and in I think all of the cases they've been remediated. The actor, the Chinese have been kicked out. So the issue is to detect it, right?
Yeah, detection is a big problem. I mean, we don't know how long they've been sleeping in our networks. I mean, it's very hard to track down, and often you track it back, could be years before it was detected. One of my questions, of course, is how come this keeps happening with our utilities? And it's not just the Chinese, as you've illuminated in your recent reporting this week. But we've seen Iranian hackers, Russian hackers. Have I left out anybody in our systems, in our utility systems? Why, at this point, I mean, you've been reporting on this longer than I have, but I know I got into it, 15 or more years, right after 9/11 when this became a big issue.
Right.
So what's the problem, Ellen?
Well, fundamentally, cybersecurity is reactive, and you can never, you know, predicting what new tricks attackers will come up with in the future is hard to do well and almost impossible to do perfectly. And so, you know, for instance, in this case, the sort of novelish technique they used was to go in through innocuous seeming devices like routers, right? Home or office routers. Mm-hmm. And there's no security software to check for penetrations into routers. So having, you know, perfect cybersecurity is almost impossible to do. And that is why there's also a growing awareness of the need to focus on resilience, on mitigation, recovery, resilience. And that is to say, you know, you can't expect to always to keep out the attacker every time, but you can hope to get to learn, to understand, to be able to detect once the attacker has entered as soon as possible so that you can quickly isolate, maybe take your network offline or isolate from the rest of the network, find a way to kick the attacker out, maybe by, in this case, you know, resetting your credentials, your passwords and logins, doing mass resets, whatever it is that you need to do to kick them out. But, and then have resilience, backup systems, redundant systems, so that you can continue to operate your network or your critical service, whatever it is. You can't just think, you're going to try to prevent an intrusion or an attack every time.
Do you have a feeling whether this is a sort of a covert guerrilla war going on where, or you can just educate me? Is this like some sort of video game where we see them in our systems and we send up our fighters, our cyber bots to fight it out with them? Do you have any idea what that's like?
This is a steady state, warfare, really. It's nation state attackers, China, whether they're Chinese or Russian, are just incredibly persistent and motivated and will continue to do what they're doing. I mean, part of it is they're spying, right? We talked earlier about espionage, political espionage, commercial espionage. Countries are going to spy. They're going to spy on each other. No matter what you do, they're going to continue to spy. We spy on other countries, they spy on us. In terms of this sort of activity, which is newer, it's part of the Chinese military doctrine to blend or integrate what they call information warfare into their suite of weapons or tools that they can mm-hmm. use in the event of conflict or to also what they call project power. Or to coerce or to influence. And that includes not just disruption, but also influence operations, you know, using bots, fake accounts to try to shape narratives.
We have to step away for a second. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, we're back now. Speaking of which, you wrote about that not too long ago. About DOD's clandestine operations, creating fake accounts on Facebook and TikTok and elsewhere. I am not sure of all the social media where they did this, but they create all these fake accounts to try to do influence operations, to fake people into thinking this and that. And you wrote about how this was largely shut down because, one, questions of legality, and two, invasion of privacy and so on. And I think another issue is whether it was effective or not. And it wasn't.
Turned out, at least according to researchers who are tracking the impact, these accounts gained very little traction. And the actual covert, openly DOD affiliated accounts seem to get more followers and more views and more clicks. So I also just reported recently, maybe last week, that the Pentagon, the commands, and largely Cyber Central Command was the sort of the main
CENTCOM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, CENTCOM had they deleted dozens and dozens of these fake accounts, and now whenever they want to do a covert or they'd say clandestine influence operation online, they need to get sign off from the senior officials at DOD, CIA, and the State Department before they proceed. So
is this because we're overcautious based on, constitutional concerns, but we're just jittery? Or is it attributed also to the Biden administration being jittery and cautious?
I think it's a combination of caution and how effective is this really? If it's not, if the juice isn't going to be really worth the squeeze, why put something out there that could backfire or undermine your own credibility? Because if it's not done well, and you put out these accounts and you make them pretend, you think you're pretending to be the Afghan villager or the Iranian dissident, and then it turns out, people realize it's DOD. That only hurts your cause because. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, yeah, you see, it's always DOD or still say CIA, and you undermine your message.
Our adversaries, particularly Russia, China, and Iran, they don't have to worry about pesky reporters digging up this stuff and exposing it. So that's one thing that
they only have the Navalny's. And
Well, that was a particular case. Poor Mr. Navalny. God knows where he is right now. But putting aside that that's one advantage they have, that they don't have to worry too much about their methods being exposed, the reporting over the years seems to be that the Chinese and the Russians are really good at this. Are they much better at this than than us.
At what? Which part of
the part? Well, there's two parts. One, I'd like to think that we're in our second generation, at least now, of gamers. And actually, if you go back to Pokemon, you know, in the 70s, we're 50 years into gaming and so on. But I'm really talking about video game, you know, advanced stuff, the kind of stuff that Jack DeShear was doing. We're really good at this. We're a nation of young gamers. And I'd like to think that we actually have an advantage in this realm of covert cyber warfare. What do you think?
I think you should separate the technical from the psychological. And when it comes to influence operations writ large, in general, they're often hard to carry out, especially at scale. And if you look, especially, you know, with the advent of online influence operations, which burst onto the scene in the U.S., it's always been there it's been there in Europe for a lot longer, but in the U.S. in 2016, when the Russians, you know, hacked the DNC and released a bunch of emails and they tried to do things on Facebook and Twitter, a lot of that actually, I think, did not have as much gain or impact as people expect, as people thought, as was ascribed to them. I think their effectiveness was overhyped, greatly, you know, sort of exaggerated.
Talking particularly of the Russian?
Yes, I am.
Russian intrusions in the 2016 elections, and as Trump partisans have often pointed out, show me one vote that was changed because of a Russian operation. It's very hard to measure.
Right, exactly. It may not, you know, what it was they leveraged pre-existing fissures in the society, but there was so much domestic misinformation, disinformation, and vitriol going back and forth. You didn't really need the Russians to try to create all that chaos. It was here already. And so
they just lit a fire, yeah.
Yeah, now the Russians influence operations just generally have more purchase. They gain more purchase in their own near abroad, their neck of the woods, amongst Russian speakers, either domestically or in, you know, countries of the former Soviet Union. That's where their information and influence operations will just be more effective. I mean, it comes off as more organic, first of all. Mm-hmm. And those are really the ones who they want to try to influence, to keep in their sphere. Same with China. Their influence ops are often directed primarily at their diaspora or their Chinese speakers, and that's where they tend to also have more, you know, more effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk to talk about the other side of it, the kind of things that you've just reported on, what the Chinese are doing to us, getting inside our utilities and so on, laying low there for the moment when we're going to have conflict. Do you have a feeling for how good we are at penetrating Chinese utilities, banks, airport systems?
I think there's a lot of hype there too. My reporting, I have seen no evidence. I have no reason to believe that the U.S. is going into civilian electric grids in Russia or China to potentially disrupt. In fact, I know, you know, fact that they didn't do that in Russia.
Why not?
Well, because it's just not what the U.S. do. They're more focused on, okay, military command and control systems. Those are key and legitimate targets. I don't think, for instance, they are going into civilian water systems to try to be able to disrupt. I mean, that would just not be in keeping with what I think you talked about earlier about caution. There are tons of lawyers, right? Cybercrime, NSA, CIA, and the intelligence agencies, and they're off forever looking at what is, you know, sort of proportionate and legitimate and discriminate in terms of targeting, including in cyber. And the U.S. government has also been working on international norms, and they're behind this norm that targeting civilian critical infrastructure is a no-no.
Is there? We have too many lawyers in the machinery there.
There's lawyers there's diplomats. I mean, it's like, you know, there are norms. That doesn't mean that they're not looking, you know, that they don't have very active espionage campaigns going on. I mean, the NSA is, you know, some of the...
Absolutely.
You know that.
And, you know, the Israelis, according to published reports, recruited an Iranian to put a thumb drive or whatever into various systems that they have to destabilize their nuclear program, mm-hmm. and also to steal records, their vaults, of what they recorded what they had been doing themselves. So I would like to think that, you know, a top priority of U.S. intelligence is to recruit a Chinese scientist or someone in the woodwork to put a thumb drive or whatever the technique in Chinese networks so we can start collecting information for espionage purposes, so we know what's going on there, and also for potential disruption operations.
Yeah, and then those sorts of bespoke ops are much more the province of the CIA, right? And, you know, it's been reported how much the network of agents and assets they had in China was decimated.
Yeah.
And building it back up is painstaking and tough.
Can't imagine a harder target than China, even harder than Russia for lots of reasons. Mm-hmm. In any event, let's circle back to your current reporting about Chinese penetration here. You wrote that the Biden administration has taken several steps to, force water and energy systems to adopt cybersecurity rules. You wrote three states sued the administration, charging regulatory overreach. So now the agency, in this case the EPA, must rely on states to report their threats voluntarily. That sounds like a mess to me. I mean, if you're trying to get some sort of coherent defense right. policy against these intrusions.
Right. And I mean, and all that was too was redoing reporting on their public water audits. So, you know, the effort to institute mandatory rules, regulations is only sort of proceeding in fits and starts. When Colonial Pipeline happened, that gave the effort a huge boost because all of a sudden everyone was really on edge and scared and say, oh my God, this could happen to me. And that also helped spur more political momentum, right, behind the idea that we really do need to have regulations and we can't just rely on voluntary efforts alone. But, you know, people, you've been around long enough to know there have been efforts like this for over a decade. There was the old
Long time.
Collins, you know, effort in what, 2010, 2012. And that failed.
Is this sort of a philosophical agreement or does it go into Trumpism, deep state fears? It's just they don't want the government telling them to be aware of cyber threats. Jeez. Yeah.
Companies just don't want to have to be told what to do. I mean, it adds more, especially if they have to report back on whether they are complying with guidelines, rules, that adds costs, you know, regulatory compliance costs. But there's also the argument to be made that because systems, especially industrial control systems, are so each one of them are different, and they're different than the administrative IT regular systems that you and I work on, that you can't have a one-size-fits-all set of regs, and you shouldn't prescribe. So there's thinking that you should.
So it's over-prescribing.
Right.
Telling them exactly what to do.
Yeah. Not going to work. The idea is rather to say, this is the outcome we want you to get to. You figure out the best way to get there, but you're going to be responsible for hitting that outcome of security.
Makes sense to me. I can see them thinking, some of these utilities or state authorities thinking, you're just going to layer a whole bunch of bureaucracy on it. It's a requirement to issue this report and that report,
right,
and it's not really going to enhance our security. Do you get a feeling that the Biden administration is coming up with something better, or are they too busy with everything else?
No, I mean, they have been doing a lot of work in this area, including an executive order on cybersecurity, and especially around with contractors, and making sure that contractors who do work for the government are meeting, you know, standards set there. So they're they've been rolling out sector by sector different efforts. They're,
okay.
You know, like I think I said in the story that after Colonial Pipeline, they did announce a rule for pipelines. It's being revised after outcry from industry. But what I hear from industry is that they like the way it's going, so that the end result will probably be a better rule. So different sectors are at different states of having regulations. The power electric system, electricity has had rules for a long, long time. They're so complicated. I don't pretend to understand the full system, but
well,
they're doing.
Maybe nobody does, and that's the problem.
Right.
Well, but thanks to reporting from you and some other like-minded, skilled reporters, you brought this problem to the public's attention, and maybe even to important segments of state and local, as well as federal officials. This is a big problem. And it needs to be, it can't be entirely solved, as you suggested, because the adversaries have all these tools and,
right,
they have sliders and curveballs and fastballs and knuckleballs that they can throw at us, and it's hard to hit them every time.
Yeah.
I have a feeling we'll be back talking about this again in the not too distant future. So, but anyway, Alan, thank you so much for your time today and to come in and explain all this complicated stuff to us. And you've thrown out there a few threads of hope that we're going to get on top of this and defending ourselves a little bit better should we get into crunch time with China. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jeff. Great being with you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk or, hey, use AI, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And, oh, by the way, the music you've been hearing? That's the soundtrack for War Games, the iconic 1983 techno thriller, which starred Matthew Broderick as a teenage computer hacker who unwittingly accessed the U.S. military supercomputer, triggering a false alarm that threatens to start a life-ending nuclear war. Could never happen here, right? I'm Jeff Stein for Spy Talk. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life? From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.